This podcast episode is sponsored by Audible. Get a free 30-day trial and any audiobook of your choice. Any book for free by going to audibletrial.com/chocolate. The show is also sponsored by FreshBooks. Everyone who works on the show is a freelancer, and we all know the pain of organizing expenses. FreshBooks is a godsend and custom-made for small businesses. Try it out for a month for free. Just go to gofreshbooks.com/chocolate.
We've got some that are very fruity, others that are more earthy.
Welcome to the Slow Melt. I'm Simran Sethi, and that's Sam Maruta of Maru Chocolate, talking to us from his home in Ho Chi Minh City and describing the flavor of cocoa from Vietnam.
We're actually one of the very few bean-to-bar makers who make chocolate in the country of origin of the cacao. So all our chocolate is made in Vietnam with Vietnamese cacao.
And that location has some pretty remarkable implications when it comes to flavor.
It's a terroir thing. I mean, for lack of a better word and for lack of a better understanding of what terroir really means, but there's definitely differences. And the differences can be quite important, even within small regional or geographic variations, if you want. I think that the fact that it's on such a narrow island, there must be something about the soil there that's quite special.
That's something that's really struck me, that even when we talk about a country, there's not a single flavor for a country because of what you said. It's like it varies from region to region, even within a small place.
No, absolutely. It's a bit like asking, you know, what's the flavor of French wine? It's...
Sam and Maru are part of a growing group of people dedicated to preserving and celebrating the biodiversity of cacao, which, of course, are the seeds of the colorful pods that become chocolate. Now, this is a completely different model and market than commodity cacao, which is grown in places like West Africa. That cocoa is grown primarily for yield. It's like the difference between commodity corn and wheat that's grown in most of the United States versus heirloom varieties. Commodity crops and foods are, by definition, fungible, which means that a crop from one place can be replaced by a crop from another. So wheat from, say, Kansas is considered the same as wheat from North Dakota. Or cocoa from Ghana is considered the same as cocoa from Indonesia. Now, the goal, as Lisa Schroeder from Mars explained in Show 5, is consistency. We want a Twix or M&M to taste the same every time we reach for it. But Maru and other specialty makers are trying to highlight something else. Difference. They want to celebrate seasonality and try to draw out the different flavors in the cocoas that they source. Now, Maru does this in part through work with the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund. The HCP was launched in 2012 with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Fine Chocolate Industry Association, and it's an initiative to identify interesting, high-quality cacao and also certify the farmers who grow it. So the idea is that by raising the profiles of farmers, we'll have a better chance of getting them higher prices for their crops.
We really welcome initiatives like the HCP, where you have a bunch of really, really passionate and knowledgeable people, and their mission is to scour the world to find the best cacao.
Well, you're lucky number 13, HCP. They've awarded heirloom designation to cacaos from North, Central, South America, but this 13th designation was for cacao from Asia.
Yes.
Tell us the story of Mr. Kong on Treasure Island.
Well, how can I describe it? First of all, it's part of the Tinjiang province in the Mekong Delta. So Tinjiang in Vietnamese means the first arm. It means it's the northernmost arm of the Mekong Delta. It's the first part of the river that you're going to cross if you come south from Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon down into the river delta. And the island called, its real Vietnamese name is not Treasure Island, it's Tan Phu Don. So Eastern Treasure new treasure. You could translate it like that. This island is in the middle of the arm of the Mekong. The Mekong is a huge river. I mean, by the time it hits Vietnam, it's been flowing all the way from the Himalayas, thousands of miles away. So by the time it reaches Tan Phu Dong Island, it's almost reaching the ocean. I think the tip of the island is only probably about 20 or 30 kilometers from the ocean. And so it's very flat. There's water everywhere. It's quite lush. There's a lot of coconuts. And on this narrow island, under the coconuts, there's a bit of cacao growing. We first found out about this cacao about 3 or 4 years ago. And we were completely blown away by how different it tasted. And, you know, the flavor profiles that we found in this cacao was really exceptional, something extremely, extremely mild, but with really, really interesting notes of spices, especially cinnamon and honey. So straight away, when we found out about this cacao, we thought, well, we could put it into our normal bars, but it would be a bit of a waste. So we actually created two different bars around this cacao. One is called Treasure Island, and the other is called Heart of Darkness. And they're kind of our star chocolate bars. You talked about Lucky 13. It could almost be Unlucky 13 for Mr. Com, because what happened is in 2016, about a year ago, during the dry season, the Mekong Delta, with El Nino and, you know, all the climate change things happening, experienced its worst drought in living memory. And a place like Mr. Kong's farm was totally ravaged by the drought. So it's something that in the Mekong Delta, people are unprepared for because there's water everywhere. And what happened is, you know, we went there during the drought and it looked okay because there's ditches and there's water in the ditches everywhere. The problem is, with no rain for such a long time, the water that is used for irrigation became salty. Mm-hmm. So more than 30% of the trees on the plantation died, and they have to be replanted. And the rest of the trees are still convalescent, so the production is extremely, extremely low. So we haven't actually been able to make any of the chocolate bars. We were talking about the Treasure Island and Heart of Darkness since we ran out of the 2016 harvest.
So
it's almost like when you read about a new species being discovered in a forest that's just been wiped out. We get a sense that the cacao coming from there is truly exceptional. It's also very, very fragile from an ecological point of view.
How has Mr. Kong responded to all of this? From the challenges he was facing to you purchasing the cacao and then all the way through to this designation?
Mr. Kong is this really, really laid-back character. We often joke that he's the most Hawaiian of our Vietnamese farmers. he always wears his flowery shirts and his hair is longer than the, you know, average fashion for a 50-year-old Vietnamese farmers. So he's this extremely easygoing guy, and these people are extremely resilient. I mean, they've lived through wars and hardship, and for them, you know, a bad harvest is a bad harvest. They're farmers, they're used to it. He's disappointed, but he's going to replant cacao trees, and we still, you know, support him because we believe in the cacao coming from his farm, and we're doing everything we can to support him.
Terrific. And this, so as I understand it, with the timing you just mentioned, this designation came at a point when there isn't any more cacao for him to actually sell. Is that
That's correct?
Oh. Be still, my dark heart. Oh.
Yes. So if there's any shops out there that still have Treasure Island or Heart of Darkness bars, they can hang on to them preciously.
So the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund says that the HCP designation helps farmers get a higher price for their cacao. And I was wondering if that was actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to talk about price premium, we place a price premium. As you know, the market price is quite low at the moment. It's quite depressed. And, you know, when you talk to people in the industry, they're like, oh, so you've lowered your supply costs. And actually, we've increased our buying price. You know, we've gone against the market. We've raised our price, whereas the market was heading south.
The price Maru pays for cacao was, at one point, a premium about 10 to 20% above the commodity price. But when those commodity prices plummeted because of a bumper crop in West Africa, the company decided to stop tracking against the market. So Sam says Maru now pays about twice the commodity rate for its specialized cocoa.
So what happens in Ivory Coast and Ghana has nothing to do with, you know, our needs and our needs for really good cacao that's grown in Vietnam. So we want to encourage farmers to plant more cacao, to harvest more, to produce better fermentation. So we're really out there to maximize their income. And one of our long-term goals is not just for the farmers to make a living now, but for their activity to be interesting enough for their children to take over when they retire.
Man, you nailed it. That is absolutely perfect, because that is a challenge that is I feel, never talked about enough. You know, that this isn't just about this moment, but about a legacy for farmers' futures. And, you know, we see that's one of the biggest challenges in Cote d'Ivoire is the fact that, you know, farmers don't want to do this work. They're not getting paid enough to do it. So.
Yeah, and you know, in a lot of countries, you've got people talking about, you know, we need to boost the local community so they can build roads and schools. And in Vietnam, these are not issues. There's already roads, there's already schools. Actually, the children of our farmers went to school, they went to college, they have jobs in the city. The big challenge is, you know, our farmers like Mr. Kong, who's in his 50s, when he wants to retire, is somebody going to take over from him? That's a big challenge.
So how do we keep farmers working in cocoa? Well, they have to get paid more than just a surviving wage, and they have to have viable plants. The Cocoa Research Center in Trinidad is working to save cocoa plants that might make farming more productive and also ensure we have cocoa in the future.
Okay, I am Pathu Maharan. I am from the Cocoa Research Center. I am the director of the center, and the center does conservation of the genetic resources. We have in possession one of the largest cocoa collections in the world, called the International Cocoa Gene Bank, Trinidad. In addition to that, we do research to try to exploit the genes in this gene bank towards supporting the growth of the industry. Most of the cocoa grown around the world comes from perhaps around 22 progenitors.
Progenitors are the ancestral plants that the majority of cocoa comes from. Now, on an industrial level, we tend to grow the same varieties of cocoa and other crops over and over again. And what that means is that other types that might have certain traits that we need or might need in the future, like resistance to disease or tolerance to drought, they start to disappear. Unless, of course, we save them.
So the cocoa industry rests on a precariously small amount of diversity. But what does that mean? It means that in the face of assaults by pests and diseases or climate change that we talk about, or problems of heavy metal contamination of soils, the industry relies on the genes that are conserved to provide some sort of tolerance to such stressors so that, you know, we can keep the industry going. So consider it like an insurance policy. Without this, you know, the industry, the chocolates that we love, we may not be able to consume in the future.
90% of cocoa is grown by small subsistence farmers. Now, if we don't increase the productivity of cocoa and reduce those costs of production, if we don't make cocoa farming profitable for farmers, Puth says that we won't have chocolate to enjoy in the future. And that conservation is actually one of the most important things that we should be doing around cocoa.
Yes, indeed. You know, and so that is why we try to we have a collection that we have established based on collecting from the cocoa varieties from the Amazon jungles where the cocoa actually originated, and having them here in Trinidad, which is further away from where it originated, provides us some sort of an insurance against things that may happen in the jungle, the forest fires, the illegal logging, and all of those that can result in the genetic resources that exist there being eroded away in the longer term.
This collection, and others like it, exist for all kinds of crops and for the elements that make foods flourish. We save plants and seeds, of course, but we also save cattle embryos, honeybee sperm, and microbes like yeast, all in backup collections throughout the world that hold traits that we might someday need to improve our food. This is called ex situ conservation. Ex situ is Latin for out of place. So walk me through that, if you will. I mean, I'm imagining, these cocoa pods, colorful, growing in the jungle. And how do they get from there all the way to Trinidad? Like, how is that material collected, those plants?
So it was done through a lot of hard work by researchers over the past 100 years who had trekked all the hard treks in the Amazon jungles. And they have gone and collected these varieties very meticulously in Ecuador, in Peru, and parts of Colombia, and brought them back to Trinidad. And that started because Trinidad, in the early part of the last century, faced a serious problem called the witch's broom disease, which devastated the cocoa industry in Trinidad. And Trinidad at the time was the fourth largest producer of cocoa in the world. And that was a major hit to the economy of Trinidad. And the researchers went into the jungles really to save these cocoa varieties, to bring them here and look for these resistant genes and breed them into our cocoa varieties, which actually saved the industry in Trinidad. And so here's a lesson where a particular problem was completely alleviated through finding the genes, the right genes from the forests.
Scientists collected genetic material from different places and planted them in Trinidad in areas that were highly susceptible to disease. If the plants didn't succumb, that meant that they were resistant to the diseases and were just the kinds of cocoa that breeders would want to use to create new varieties.
So now, of course, we have a lot more better technologies where we can use molecular markers to identify these genes that confer resistance in a much more precise way. And that is what our research is doing now. What we used to do, which took about 20, 30 years of breeding to get, we can now do it much more accurately, more precisely in a shorter time using these genetic tools.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So then what, when you talk about this vast kind of pool of resources in the form of this genetic diversity, how many plants are stored in the collection?
In the collection, we have about 2,400 cocoa varieties. We also have about 14 wild species that are related to cocoa that were also collected from the Amazon jungles. And each of these varieties are cloned carefully and conserved in the collection as a field collection, with each variety represented by 16 trees. So that gives some level of insurance. Even if one tree dies, then you have another 15 more that you can get these genes from.
Right. That's a good backup. That sounds like a generous backup.
Yeah.
So you know, one of the things I didn't ask is, and the reason that so much of this material was, recovered from the Amazon jungle is because that is the area where there is the most diversity for cacao. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's quite correct. You know, and each of the different crops originate in different parts of the world, and the cocoa happened to have originated in the eastern part of South America. In the jungles of Peru and Ecuador and Colombia and parts of Brazil. So this is where the cocoa originated. So much of the diversity for this cocoa tree resides in this region. So that is why we always go back there, you know, to collect these diversity.
So what can we do to help support conservation?
There are lots we can do, I mean, to support it. We are trying to approach the companies that produce all these chocolates and so on to develop a sort of endowment fund that can foster these collections in posterity, that, you know, we have this insurance policy, these banks being in existence into the future. But at the same time, the consumers, I think, also have a role. We have a Save a Tree campaign. We are, you know, different... Individuals can contribute to saving a tree within the collection. We also have launched a conservation chocolate at Woodblock in Oregon. Where people who buy the chocolate also contributes to the conservation of genetic resources, because the proceeds of that chocolate comes back to the collection itself. So we are trying our best to connect to the society at large to see how best we can really support this collection in posterity, at the same time have the resources to maintain it in a good condition for posterity as well.
I love that part of the solution is eating chocolate. That always works. If you're interested in learning more about the loss of biodiversity in crops like cocoa and how we can save foods by conserving and savoring them, check out Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. The book explores the loss and restoration of biodiversity through bread, wine, chocolate, coffee, and beer. You can get that audiobook, or any book you'd like, for free on Audible as part of a free 30-day trial. Give it a try at audibletrial.com/chocolate.
So you drive about an hour up into the hills. About halfway, you're on a paved road, and then you start hitting potholes. And then you might get stuck in a couple ditches, and... you know, that can, and if there's a lot of rain, it can be quite an experience. So you get to El Guineal, which is the town after about an hour drive from San Francisco to Marcos, and it's a classic small campo village in the Dominican Republic. And then you take a right, there's a sign that says Reserva Zorzal. And then you kind of come up to this point where you can see the 700 acres to the left, and that's all wet broadleaf forest. And to the right, there's cocoa, and that's shade grown as well. So you go along this ridge, and then you come down into where our fermentary is. And there's a beautiful river that passes through the reserve, and the beautiful smells of cocoa.
That's Charles Kirshner, the CEO of Zorzal Cacao, describing the bird sanctuary and organic cacao farm that he co-founded. Now, while the Cocoa Research Center preserves diverse types of cacao away from where they grow, Charles is part of an effort to save diverse varieties in the places where they're cultivated, what's known as in situ or in-place conservation.
So in Latin America and the Caribbean, there is a lack of financing for protected areas. And the Dominican Republic has a widespread, over 126 protected areas. So it's they have a lot of public protected areas, but there's a lack of resources. So how can we, through sustainable financing mechanisms, through cocoa, you know, conserve habitat? And how it works is really it's the 70% of the land is forever wild. So we do have bird-friendly cocoa, you know, shade-grown. We've done some research there. But the real design is to produce on about 200 acres or 250 acres or so, cocoa, and be able to finance that protected area through that.
So cocoa's a really interesting crop. It has been and still is a significant source of tropical deforestation. But when it's grown under a shade canopy, the plant nourishes the soil and offers refuge to birds and to insects like the midges that pollinate the crop.
So from a conservation perspective, it's definitely important for birds. So that's our main focus is bird habitat. And it's also good for production of cocoa. Now, I will say it depends on how much rainfall you get in the area. So, you know, you don't want to be in full sun, especially if you don't have irrigation. Your plants will dry out. So you do want some shade for productivity of your cocoa beans and your cocoa trees.
When you were looking at crops that could be cultivated to support this conservation, why did you decide on cacao?
Two things. One is that, well, first, I'm biased towards cacao. I love cacao. I love what it brings, the connections it brings for me personally to farming, to villages, to culture, what it brings, smiles to people's faces when you, you know, give them a chocolate bar and that connection it makes to people. And then another thing is the bird we're focused on, the Bicknell thrush, flies from Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine to the Dominican Republic. So there's kind of bilateral connection between chocolate, cocoa beans also being exported to North America. So it's kind of this benefits transfer. The birds flying there, the cocoa is we can export the cocoa to North America, Europe. So that's kind of a nice, like, you know, balance. So there's the kind of, you know, my desire to, quite frankly, to work in cocoa, I think drove a lot of it. But B, we are also in the breadbasket of cocoa of the Dominican Republic is the area where the reserve is. So we are fortunate to have such a fantastic crop to be able to produce and export.
Charles says the Dominican Republic is the world's top producer of organic cacao. And the country is also one of the top growers of the specialized cacao you find in craft chocolate, which is where makers and chocolate lovers come in. Now, we've talked about how farmers and conservationists save diverse cacao, but what we find in makers like Maru and in designations like the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Designation are efforts to also involve consumers. We save diverse cacao by savoring the chocolate it ends up in.
You know, the craft chocolate industry is a perfect example where it's consuming less cocoa overall, but at a higher quality and higher price points. So it's not all about, you know, massive consumption. It's more about enjoying the quality.
Zorzal supplies cocoa to craft chocolate makers, including Dandelion, Rocca, and Potomac chocolate.
So I guess what Zorzal Cacao is doing is really testing the boundaries of trying to implement what we write about and what, you know, academics says and what research is, and really bring that on the ground to make change. There's high risks in it, but yeah, again, like that quote, you know, you have to test it and you have to do it, or it's just we will make a difference at the end of the day.
I love it. That challenge extends to all of us, right? It's like put your
don't be afraid
action
of failure.
Where your thought is.
Yep. And it's hard, but it's rewarding for sure at the end of the day. Yeah. And a lot of people are doing in the craft chocolate industry. So a lot of accolades need to go out to yourself and others. So yeah, I'm just excited to be part of this.
I'm the messenger man, and I just get to eat the results. So
I know. I get to eat the results.
Praise the makers.
You know?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All praise to the growers and the makers and those who get to indulge in their efforts. Because, you know, without application.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah.
No, I agree. It's a beautiful world. Yep.
Thanks to our show sponsor, FreshBooks, the user-friendly invoicing software that's designed to help freelancers and small businesses get organized and get paid. Try it out for free for a month by going to gofreshbooks.com/chocolate. You can find links to today's guests and information on our other shows on theslowmelt.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at theslowmelt. The show is written by me, Simran Sethi, and this episode was mixed and produced by Sean Corey Campbell and edited by Sasha Woodruff, with production assistance from Katie Ranke. On our next few episodes, we'll be exploring two key regions for chocolate, where it was born and where it lives. Stay tuned, and Choco love for tuning in.